AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon as we're joined now by Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown, his website, minnesotabrown.com, as he is someone that tracks not only politics, but generally what's happening in northern Minnesota and specifically on the Iron Range. And today he has an excellent column in the Minnesota Reformer titled Iron Range Labor's Maturity and Decline. Highly encourage you to check it out as it really breaks down what's happening on the Iron Range in terms of unions and what the future could possibly hold for labor overall. Aaron joins us now on the show. Hey, Aaron, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Brett. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing I'd like to start off with, and this is something you and I have talked about before, but it's easy for someone like me in the Twin Cities or anyone else who lives in the Twin Cities that doesn't get to the Iron Range often to realize that unions are not just one monolithic group, especially, well, really anywhere. There are many different subgroups of unions, whether it's industrial, trade, service worker, or government unions. And I think it's important to make that distinction when we talk about labor on the Iron Range, is that it's not just one monolithic group, as all four of these groups have very different interests. If you can expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, and not only is that true now, but it's been true since the beginning of the labor movement, and there have been actually big political implications of this from the beginning, and it's probably not too terribly surprising that we're experiencing some of the same things now. As you pointed out, there's different kinds of unions. In America, a lot of the union movement, and not to be too much of a boring history lesson, but the guild movement, the trade unionists, were some of the earliest examples of unions in America, and certainly that was true in Minnesota as well. That they're really what you would now call your trade unions to some extent. And that group has always been protective of their trade, of their what they do for a living, and protective of their job classifications. And that's been very good for the people who do those jobs, and it's been very lucrative if you look over time at how wages and benefits have gone. But that hasn't necessarily represented the larger body of workers. That's where the industrial unions came along in the 20th century and had some success. And so when we look at big unions on the range, we're known for the United Steelworkers of America, the steelworkers, the miners. That they have also represented the paper workers at the paper mills, the steelworkers have. And so those are the big unions that started representing large groups of workers beyond just the skilled trades. And those unions, in fact, they were the reason they took them so long to organize is because they were, from the very beginning, accused of being socialist and, you know, far too leftist for genteel society to handle. And so when we look at the post-World War II shift of the Iron Range towards the Democrats and the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in particular, that was a product of the strong growth of the industrial union, the United Steelworkers. And now, as we're watching, and this is kind of the thrust of my piece, as this has shifted, as politics have shifted, and as the workplaces have changed because of automation and efficiencies and consolidation of the industry, there's fewer workers still in these very mature, good union contracts. And now the industrial unions, such as those at the mines, have become more like the trade unions in that they're protecting job classifications, they're protecting mature, strong contracts. And as a result, politically, that they're no longer wedded to the grand notion of one big union or workers of the world unite or some of these ideas that were behind the origins of the industrial union movement. And that's, I don't know which came first, the political shift or the union shift, but regardless, it's explainable and observable in our political shift here in northern Minnesota and in places like that, in the Rust Belt, for instance, across Ohio and Indiana and Pennsylvania, where these formerly, and Michigan, where these formerly rock-ribbed blue/union voters are now kind of up in the air, 50-50, maybe a little more socially conservative and certainly less receptive to liberal arguments on a lot of issues. And that's now being reflected in the unions. And what is that going to mean for unions and for workers? And will unions be able to survive this if, for instance, the Conservative Party that they're aligning with decides they want right to work nationwide, or if they don't feel they need unions anymore? So that's, how's that going to go? And we're going to find out. But that's what the piece is about.
And another thing you point out is that there actually are more healthcare workers, I believe, than union workers currently on the Iron Range, which is a pretty shocking. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say that's true. There are more healthcare workers, for instance, on the Iron Range than there are miners. That's a fact that it's been true for a long time, and I think a lot of people still don't realize that. I work in Hibbing, and in Hibbing, the biggest employer is the hospital. Second biggest employer is Hibbing Taconite. And that's been true not just recently, but for 20 plus 30 years. And now those workers in the healthcare fields are unionized as well, or at least many of them are, gotcha. But not all of them. And the unions aren't as strong as, say, the steel workers. They were never as politically influential, Minnesota Nurses Association and others. Now, they have a role, and they have success in their own way, but, you know, in terms of dollars and political influence, they're not nearly as powerful as the steelworkers. And that's kind of what we're seeing. And as more people work in the medical fields, now granted COVID is throwing a wrench in that, that's getting to be a whole other story. But as we're watching the healthcare fields become so big, businesses in rural Minnesota, some of the biggest growth businesses are assisted living facilities. And many times those facilities are completely non-union. CNAs and others that are non-union, and you know, those are where more workers are going. Retail, service sector jobs, probably the biggest sector of the economy, mostly non-union. And so as these big unions with these historical achievements for the labor movement kind of mature, age into, you know, their sunset years potentially, there's all these other workers in places, not just the Range. I mean, I know I write about the Range, and that's what the story is about. But it's really applicable to the whole labor force across America, across the industrialized world right now. And so it's an interesting question for the future of unions and organized, you know, collective bargaining. Where do the workers fall in this big question that's coming over value of labor?
And that is a big question for the future of labor, because obviously expenses have risen dramatically over the past few years, especially when it comes to childcare. And that's a real struggle that people face not only on the Range, but really all over the country, is being able to afford childcare. It's a big, big expense. Now, a lot of the union jobs up on the Range do actually provide enough money where you can handle those types of expenses. But as you're talking about, so many people are working in now these non-union jobs, or maybe in the healthcare industry where the unions aren't quite as strong or as mature as the steelworkers union. That does pose some challenges when it comes to the future of labor, of how do you make sure people are making enough money to handle these types of expenses, whether it comes to healthcare and benefits or finding childcare for children.
You look at the big debate, and it's still ongoing to some degree, about the labor force, and, you know, why are there so many fast food places that can't seem to hire workers? And, of course, a few months ago it was kind of the vogue to say that the unemployment benefits was the reason why people were sitting home getting rich on unemployment checks and therefore not working. But from the very beginning, I mean, you might be able to find examples of people who were doing that, but from the very beginning, the most obvious issue, if you talk to people, was that they couldn't find childcare for their children while they had to go, while they were going back to work. And if you talk to, and I'm not even talking just about lower income workers, the working poor, if we want to use that term. I mean, if you talk to people in professional jobs who might move to a new town or change jobs, people who have stayed home to take care of children and want to go back into the workforce, you know, it's not only the cost, which is significant to get childcare, it's just the straight up access. It's the waiting lists. It's the minimum hour requirements for childcare that are making it really difficult for people to go back to work. And the people most disproportionately affected by this, and the working poor. And so, you know, this is the question I guess I'm also asking in this piece, happy Labor Day, I guess, it's the Labor Day piece, is where are these workers fitting into this question of, you know, getting their share of the pie? Why are we so averse to addressing the problem of childcare? Why is that, frankly, a liberal issue when it really is a societal issue and could be addressed more robustly for the benefit of businesses and workers alike? And that's where an organized collective bargaining approach for those workers probably could have the most success. And who's got the courage to do that? Who's got the attention span to stick with it? And that's the big question, I think, facing the state going forward.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown about his recent column that he wrote in the Minnesota Reformer titled Iron Range Labor's Maturity and Decline. You can find that over at MinnesotaReformer.com or also Aaron's website, MinnesotaBrown.com. And I want to move on to another topic, and this has to do with an upcoming union drive by the United Steelworkers of America at the Iron Range's only non-union taconite plant. That's North Shore Mining in Babbitt and Silver Bay. And I want to talk to you about this, Aaron, because as you write, their pitch this year for unionization is a little bit different from what union pitches have been in the past, from what we typically see on the range, if you can expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, I wrote about this as part of that same column in the Reformer. And it is a newsworthy item that they're doing this. It's kind of been the white whale for the steelworkers, the fact that one of these taconite mines has been non-union all these years, one of the original taconite plants in the region. And it's been a struggle for them because kind of culturally, the company's gotten used to not being union, and the workers have now been kind of skeptical of you paying union dues because they enjoy some of the same benefits thanks to the contracts that are negotiated at other taconite plants. In the past, the old CIO, the original Industrial Union Confederation, the pitch was one big union, we're all in this together, all boats will float if we stick together and demand our fair share of the profits from commerce. And that's not nearly what the pitch is nowadays. And frankly, it's become more of a direct personal appeal, personal financial appeal to the workers saying, hey, listen, we're over here at these union plants and we've negotiated stock options. We've negotiated, contribution plans for your private defined contribution benefits plans. You're not getting those because you aren't on the contract. If you got on the contract, you'd be doing better. Your family would have more money, and you'd pay your dues back. We'd pay for your dues and more. That's the pitch. It's personal. It's individualistic. And that's, I think, probably the biggest change in unions like the steelworkers, is that it is gone from kind of we're all in this together, the big collectivist movement, into a much more individualistic, we're in this for our own families and securities, and it's all about maximizing what we get out of this business arrangement. Well, that's fine. There's a certain point of view that's the way it should be, some would say. But in a practical sense, politically, it really puts those unions on the same side of the table as the companies they negotiate with. And it really puts all the eggs in the basket of profits, corporate profits. And that means that the corporation can do no wrong. And that's an attitude that has prevailed on the Iron Range before, but it's been almost a century when U.S. Steel was the largest company on earth and controlled communities of northern Minnesota, frankly, with an iron fist. And so, is that where we're headed, or is there a different future? And that's the questions we're settling in our debate and discussion about issues like this.
Absolutely, because if I think about this from a company perspective, most companies, of course, don't want their labor force to actually unionize. But if there is going to be a push, they probably want to see that type of union movement where it's much more focused on the individual worker rather than, oh, let's all be in this together and try to improve everybody. So it's certainly beneficial from the company's perspective, at least to a degree. And it kind of expands on something that I think you wrote about, too, talking about how now unions on the range rarely speak out against their employers. They have a very close relationship for them. So that relationship has certainly changed as well.
Tellingly, Cleveland Cliffs, now the largest mining company in Minnesota, iron mining company, is not contesting the union campaign at North Shore. They're not contesting it. And they don't mind if they unionize. It really doesn't make a difference to them. And that kind of tells you where the union movement is at. You know, it's so compatible now with frankly, the corporate model that it doesn't really matter to them. They might be out a little bit of money, but they have everybody in the same boat then, and they have a little bit of clarity because they know everybody's on the same contract. So, you know, it's no difference to them, which tells you that, you know, they're probably not sticking the burrs in the company like they used to in the old days.
Yeah, I'm sure if you were to tell someone about what's happening today, even 30 or 40 years ago, it would just, what? This is happening now? The companies aren't even contesting their being a union? Yeah, it would probably just seem to be a foreign concept to someone that you'd be talking about on the range 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yep.
Well, Aaron, I really thank you for the time today. That is Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown. Make sure you check out his recent column in the Minnesota Reformer as we are coming up on Labor Day, and always good to reflect on the future of labor as Aaron wrote an excellent column titled Iron Range's Labor Maturity and Decline. Find that over at MinnesotaReformer.com or Aaron's own website, MinnesotaBrown.com. Aaron, as always, appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Brett.
All right, let's take a break and send things back to Matt McNeil up next on AM 950.